Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're diving into, we're still kind of swimming on the right of the Second Amendment, or I should say the responsibility of the Second Amendment, along with the right of the people to be able to maintain weaponry due to this constitutional responsibility. In other words, in a way, is this a privilege, or is it an immunity, or is it a responsibility? Because, see, when people look at the fundamental right of property rights, the fundamental right to defend oneself, okay, that's, you know, that's all fair and good. But really, the context of what the Second Amendment is meaning, tell me if I'm wrong, it's far greater than just the, you know, the your right to have a gun, your right to have a weapon.
Yeah, it sounds more like a responsibility.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Not just a privilege or immunity.
Right. Oh, but okay, there you go. So the only way, and to me, let's change that from obligation. It's okay. Not just a responsibility. It's an obligation. And so as a citizen, we are obligated to defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, period. Mm-hmm. And so this goes back to this whole point of what I was trying to say is every county needs to dive into constitutional compliance, which is why, folks, when we get through the Constitution, the next stage of content will really be why counties matter most, or actually how to go and create a constitutional county. And you can't just do it like these, I'll just say, these misguided sovereign citizen gingerl assemblies. You just can't go and say, we've declared us a sovereign state or county, like the gingerl assemblies claim. Or just by disengaging from being a U.S. citizen and just so you don't have to pay property taxes. That is not the process. The process is actually uniting and working together on the principles and the fundamental law of the land, which is the Constitution. And I believe that when we peel this all back, we as a people have a responsibility to prepare everybody to be a full-fledged citizen. In other words, I honestly think that we have citizens that are literally a different states of being a citizen. You've got the inhabitants here, so your criteria of being a resident, okay, you know, you're meeting that criteria. And here's my problem. You don't meet the criteria if you're just a inhabitant. You don't meet the criteria of a voting citizen. So the voting citizen should be the epitome of a citizen in our society. It is the epitome in the standards of society or all governments that when a person becomes a full-fledged citizen, they are then endowed with the right to vote. So we have some real shortcomings because we have to get everybody into that state. And so this is where it really does require some prayer, some real work at the county and local community levels in getting people to actually, you know, ponder and pray and work together in acknowledging how bad the state really is of the state and affairs of our county. Mm-hmm. And so we have to acknowledge that, you know, I honestly think that you need to put these goals, or you need to identify, you know, what specifically has to be done so that you can have milestones and say, okay, we need to really restaff our sheriff and our law enforcement entities within this county to actually mean that the citizens within the county and subdivisions of the county, because the more populated, the more subdivisions you need to ensure, one, adequate representation, and two, because that's what we were talking about at the end of the show yesterday, was adequate representation. Do you really believe 100,000 people? I mean, the framers, George Washington poked everybody in that constitutional convention's eyes when he said that, you know, I don't feel that a citizen can be properly represented when they're competing with 29,999 other citizens.
You know, it's one of the few things that he actually spoke up about.
That's correct.
It was important enough to him.
That's correct. And so here's the question, folks. If George Washington and the framers realized that pushing 50,000 at the federal level, which has the least amount of involvement in your day-to-day lives, this is the way it's supposed to be, then why would we think that having our state representative of actually representing more than 50,000 people is okay? When the matters and issues at hand for your state legislature is much greater. And at your county level, you know, it's even greater than that. The question is, how much are we willing to pay for our government and representation? Oh, well, that, you know what? I'd rather have be heavy on representation and actually have, you know, and place the tax upon the citizens, not a financial tax, but a time obligation and a responsibility, right, of being involved and saying, you can't unplug. You know, the only reason that, you know, we have Bill Gateses in our society is because we've allowed people to be able to manipulate conditions to give them financial advantages and societal advantages, you know, over the course of generations to where they've been able to amass a level of property and affluence to be able to do these things. Because I can tell you that had we maintained our responsibilities of citizens over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, then I don't believe that we would have had a Bill Gates come. I don't believe we would have had that level of affluence. You got to remember that Rockefellers and DuPont and many of these people became influential and powerhouses in the 19th and 20th century because government started helping, getting involved. And, you know, because had everything been done without government's involvement, then, and, you know, literally on the backs of the people with open competition and so forth. Actually, the DuPont story is very fascinating because DuPont became a world contender in providing minerals such as borax. I believe it was borax it all started, and as a soap. And the Germans, you know, who were the dominators of the world, you know, saw him trying to sell borax in Europe, and so they were really upset, and they started.
Why?
Well, so because he was selling borax at a marginal cost that was well under them. So what these guys did in Germany, this is a fascinating story. Look this up, folks. What these German barons of industry did was they said, we're going to dump borax in America under cost so that everybody buys up borax from us instead of from DuPont. Well, guess what happened when they started dumping borax under cost? DuPont turned around and bought it up and shipped it back to Europe to sell at profit.
Wow.
That was a free market, but over time, DuPont started actually carrying, you know, these huge credentials and affluence. And this is where DuPont, or I should say the government in these alliances with corporations, started overstepping their bounds. I mean, when you look in America, I mean, we were treading water and we were doing things that, you know, were really inventive. I mean, Procter & Gamble was the first company ever, and I should have actually asked the question before I stated this, but Procter & Gamble in the mid-19th century, the middle 1800s, was one of the first companies to consider and actually implement profit sharing with their employees, because this was when Procter & Gamble was fighting to keep the unions out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were successful to a point, but eventually the union still prevailed. And they just shook their heads and they go, you got to be kidding me. You know, I mean, what's the whole point of the union? Is to actually take money from those, you know, from every, they become a parasite. And people didn't even realize what they did. Anyway, I digress. This is about the Second Amendment and going into the Third Amendment.
Sure. Well, that's strong language there regarding unions. Hopefully, maybe we'll have an opportunity to discuss that further.
Well, I'm sure we will, because you know, we'll actually get to 1926 and mm-hmm. the union's attempt with Calvin Coolidge's support of creating an amendment to the states to give the federal government the ability to regulate labor, to open, I shouldn't say open the doors, to reinforce the opening, the unconstitutional opening of the Constitution already by Teddy Roosevelt, you know, who created the Labor and Commerce Department, to empower them constitutionally to create regulations. Not that they weren't doing it, but go ahead.
Hang on just a minute. So, what you're saying is they wanted Coolidge to regulate labor.
No. They got Coolidge to champion the 1926 amendment, because Coolidge became a huge, very popular president, and he was in bed with labor.
I take it this didn't pass.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I take it this amendment did not pass.
No, it did not pass, correct.
Then why do we have a Department of Labor?
Well, the Department of Labor was created by Teddy Roosevelt as an unconstitutional vestige. Same thing. Actually, it was created in the early 1900s under the guise of labor and commerce. Mm-hmm. And then they split it up later on. They split up the Department of Labor and the Department of Commerce separately because they realized, wow, we got a great opportunity to start regulating labor here. Boom, boom, boom. Because they used the courts to aggrandize this power.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Yeah, I think we'll get there.
Yep. It'll be down when we get in past the early 1900 progressive eras, after the 16th, 17th, and 19th amendments.
Okay.
Is when we get to that, 1926. Because I think Prohibition, the ending of Prohibition is after this.
Okay.
Right.
Sure.
Okay.
So I guess we need to transition then from Amendment 2 if we're done with that.
Yes, we are. So we want to go into the Third Amendment.
All right, I'll read that.
And so let me preface this, because obviously the answer is in the Third Amendment. Can anybody tell me, can the federal government compel people and compel them regarding the use of their property? Do they have the ability in the Constitution to compel a person of how to use their property?
Well, notwithstanding the amendments, the answer is no.
Okay, so let's read the Third Amendment.
Okay. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law.
So in other words, it requires an act of war, and it requires an actual prescription of law to determine the quartering of soldiers on a person's property.
Okay.
But the Constitution and the Third Amendment actually allows them to do this as an ultimate essentiality or necessity. There you go. That's the proper word. It is literally an essential or necessary measure in the national defense, because you got to remember, Their limitation of holding property is limited to those enumerated powers.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't possess or hold this property, but they can, for a temporary purpose, compel a person and the use of their property to be used for national defense purposes.
Let's put this in the context and describe what it looks like, and remembering that they considered the military the militia.
That is correct. Right? That is correct.
Okay. So let's suppose that, you know, we call for the militia to go from...
Well, so actually, let's do this. Let's look at today and the military. Where are those people who are serving in the military quartered? They're quartered in barracks. In other words, when the federal government actually federalizes, they require, you know, and they've got a million or 100,000, 200,000, less than 200,000 Marines, and they probably have over a million in personnel from Army, Navy, and so forth. And so they have to quarter them somewhere because they're in permanent service, which they shouldn't be, but they're in permanent service. So they created barracks. But back in this time, they didn't have, one, the luxury of permanently, you know, federalizing, nor did they have the luxury of just creating barracks, you know, just for the, you know, creating barracks throughout the states to say, okay, we have quartering capability to be able to defend the nation, you know, and then let these things just sit there empty.
Right.
So the prescribing by law would have actually created a, well, you may not like it, but we're leasing your property and we're going to give you a stipend for using it.
Okay. For quartering military as needed.
Correct.
So we're not just talking about quartering people.
We're talking about quartering equipment, you know, food, ammo, supplies, you know, that the military will need. The logistical support that goes with it as well.
Right.
Right.
Well, it does say no soldier and shall be in a time of peace be quartered in any house.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Correct. It requires a declaration of war and a specific law in the specific areas where it has to be done. Because, you know, if all of a sudden, because of the War of 1812, the British started attacking us in different directions, and we weren't prepared, we didn't have that ability, then, you know, we would have needed to marshal and move, you know, assemble and move military, federalized militia towards that area. And, you know, you just can't let them sit out in the field. You got to quarter them somehow, you know. And, you know, this is why Washington basically used, what was the fort? It's at the tip of my tongue, where they encamped over the winter quarters and so forth. It was in Pennsylvania. What was it?
Valley Forge?
Valley Forge. Thank you. That's what it was. Yeah.
Okay.
So, thank you. See, this name problem I have, it's a vexing problem.
Okay.
And I've been living with it all my life. So, anyway. Just to be clear, though, folks, the federal government does have this one capability, and it's clear in the Constitution that they can do this one thing, but it is so constrained that they can't actually come in for any other purpose and say, you know, we're here, we're going to use your land. In other words, there have been cases like in natural disasters and defense, and so not defense, but natural disasters, what have you. The federal government's come out to, you know, help out, and they've got to, you know, come in and they quarter or what have you, and they literally use people's property. They can't. They can't do that. So whether it's the Environmental Protection Agency, it doesn't matter. It has to be an act of war. And it has to be done by law. In other words, the Congress has to declare the war, and then they have to declare by law how to deploy that federalized militia to go and, you know, repel the invasion, blah, whatever, for the three purposes of federalizing the militia. That's not for a disaster or for a natural disaster or for, you know, an environmental crisis or what have you. Okay, so the next one, we're going to dive into the Fourth Amendment. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
Okay. So, what it was included in this, because technology kind of evolved a bit, was the ability to monitor. Not only did, you know, is this Fourth Amendment affecting and protecting your person, your houses, your papers, and effects, because when they have to get a warrant, they also have to have a warrant to basically monitor you. Now, the progressive is going to say, well, it doesn't say that, but it was the progressives that basically wanted the 14th Amendment equal protection and the privileges and immunities of the Fourth Amendment and so forth to ensure that the police state could not actually monitor your phone calls, monitor what you're doing. And so even though this goes down to where this is going to be a deep dive, folks, and this is probably going to take us an episode or two. And I think you understand why, because we actually have big tech that is actually look at how much information big tech, not just big tech, are there other corporations or businesses out there that monitor you?
Well, sure.
Give me some examples.
Oh, this is easy. Okay. Let's take it slowly
because it's not that I'm trying to kill time. I want people to understand the magnitude of how this right of being secure in your person is being violated. Go ahead.
I'll give you an example. I was in the kitchen having a conversation with my wife about some particular product, and within 90 seconds, ads pop up on my Android device about that very item. My device was listening to me and then started showing me ads about what I was discussing with my wife. That was shocking. Okay. That's a modern example.
That's active monitoring. And so the company that did that was probably Google by using Android and by using back talk between your web browser and everything else that they use to actually monitor, and these other apps that they have to drive marketing to you. And but they do this in denying, they're basically saying you don't have this right to be secure in your person from this corporation. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that corporation doesn't have permission to actually come and operate on your property, do they?
Well, actually, they claim they do, because when you click yes in their service agreement, you agree to allow them to do that.
Now, okay, so let me ask you this before we go too much further. Can a U.S. citizen sign a contract that null and voids their rights and privileges and immunities?
You know, that's an interesting and deep question.
Can you sign it? So let me ask you, let's put it in very specific terms. Can you sign an HOA agreement that basically states you can't have a gun on your premises, or an HOA that says you can't produce your own food for your own benefit?
That would deny your rights.
So, but you're signing a contract that says you willingly give up your rights as a citizen, something that's protected by law.
Well, then there's another problem, and that is this, you know, organization or HOA, if it's sanctioned by the authority of a state,
isn't a corporation equally sanctioned by a state? We're running into break. Sorry about this. So we will bring this back up, because now we're going to be talking about HOAs and corporations and where they get the authority to function in your state. We're connecting the dots here for you, folks. We want you to really understand how important this stuff is. And this helps you, as you understand each of these problems, that you should actually be thinking First Amendment petitions. We'll be right back after this.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so when a corporation or an HOA creates a rule or creates a contract and actually has you sign and acknowledge that you're giving them this authority, can they actually create a law by contract that would deny you your rights?
I'm thinking that maybe not.
So let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. What's the second clause of the 14th Amendment, Section 1?
That should be easy. Let me go there.
Okay. It starts with no state shall.
Here we go. Here's what it says.
Okay.
Okay, I can see that. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States.
So even though the corporation has got a contract, and when they create that contract, does that not become a law?
Sure.
Because the law is enforceable where?
By the state.
By the state, right? Where? Specifically in the state court.
Correct.
And correct. Therefore, they then seek the state's ability to enforce a law that they created by you signing a contract that says you acknowledge that they can do these things or that you can't do these things. Does it matter whether they can do it or you can't do it? Does it matter? No.
So here's an example. You have people who are agreeing to waive their Fourth Amendment rights so that they can fly. Right?
Now explain that.
So,
because that's a real general, what you just said was general. What specifically are they doing to acknowledge so that they can fly?
Well, you go through a body scanner. All right. Your luggage is not only open. I'll tell you what, if you've got a lock on your luggage, they will cut the lock, open it, and go through your belongings. Would you not consider that an unreasonable search? And so then what happens is that you somehow in the process of agreeing to fly commercially, you, if I understand correctly, consent to being searched in this manner. Is that more specific?
Yeah, it is. But so when you go into public, let me ask you this, because we're talking about now public safety.
Okay.
Can the state government, for safety purposes, put into, I mean, now they can't deny you your right to bear arms or to transport a weapon.
Okay.
They shouldn't be able to do that.
but they should be able to basically inspect. Let's just say you have a legitimate, you know, concealed carry. You have a legitimate concealed carry. They'll say, okay, we have a policy because we actually have a marshal on every flight that will be actually carrying a weapon. Now, they have to actually prove that they have a marshal on that flight. To me, I think that they bear that, that if a person challenges them that has a legitimate concealed carry, they should actually say, okay, there is a person on this manifest that will have this. And so they don't necessarily have to prove it during the flight, but they can actually expose that. And I believe that this is about public safety.
So I
honestly believe, because can they actually inhibit your ability of free speech at the airport? Absolutely. Just the same thing with your ability to use free speech in a theater and yell fire. Because
the point is there's a consequence for saying wrong speech. If there's actually a fire,
yes, you should be able to be held liable for that. Correct.
Right.
And so
if there's actually a fire, then people should know. But if there's not, you should pay the consequence.
Correct. Right? Absolutely. Correct. So you should be, and you, I honestly, if you yelled bomb because you saw a bomb and, you know, in an airport, then you wouldn't be charged. But you better make sure that, you know, that was a bomb, or at least with all the training that you had, you can, you know, you can rationally deduce by looking at that, that that's a bomb. Okay, but you see my point. When it comes down to public safety, it's not gray. I mean, we do empower and delegate government the ability to take, I don't want to say seize control, but we grant them a level of control over our, you know, how we're going to function in a public forum. Now, an airline is not public transportation, but it is because, so let me ask you this, is that really a private company that, you know, to where only people that are members can fly? Remember, let's look at a corporation versus a private entity. A corporation is open to the public. You know, like even a law office, if their doors are open, that means their doors are open to the public. If you're a club, then you are only available
to members.
Now, there are aircraft that are private operated aircraft. In other words, it's only for very specific people. But if you're open to business for anybody that wants to buy a ticket and fly on you, then you are a part of the public domain. And so, you know, the concept of airlines being private is only private investment operations, so forth, but it is still a public domain company. Now, I was actually thinking of a different example, but I want to run this to ground. So when we look at an airline and we look at people, it's just like going into a grocery store. You almost have the equal assurance. You should have equal assurance that you won't be bombed or hurt in a grocery store.
Okay.
Because it's open to the public and there is some security, but because this vessel you're getting on has a high probability of death if something happens from point A to point B, they take a lot of measures in, I'll just say, regulating that process. But who should be regulating that process? Who gives the airlines the authority to function? It should not be the federal government. It should be the states. And then the states should actually work out whatever their rules are to actually have standards. And, you know, because bottom line, if a state wants to make so many different rules that it's just ridiculous to fly into that state, then those airlines won't provide services. I mean, you know, so in other words, when we look at what those standards are, I honestly think that there needs to be standards, but it has to come from the states. It can't come from the federal government. They don't have the enumerated power. They can't regulate it.
And that right there is literally, you know, the reason why we have all of these problems, because they have been regulating them. Not only that, they've been actually subsidizing them.
Right. And that goes back to the three vetoes of the Department of Transportation.
Correct. Very much so. So these, the train companies, the airline, the cruises, all of these things should be regulated by the states where they operate. Period.
I can hear the argument now about having a standardization of regulations.
Ah, and I'm okay with that, because this actually starts begging the problem, because we already kind of covered this with Article 1, Section 10, where the states don't have the ability right now to create a compact to come together and say, we need to have national standards between us. Mm-hmm. Because that's okay. What really needs to happen so that the states can be better served. But to give that and just carte blanche, give full control to the federal government, it never bodes well for we the people, folks. It hasn't.
Go ahead. So my concern about unreasonable search and seizure, which you're saying has to be balanced for the public safety.
If a public safety issue is really, it's playing on the table, boom, that's a public safety issue, then, because I think reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. And I believe that everybody would look and say, okay, if you want to fly on a real private aircraft, then, you know, the aircraft can actually, you know, dictate anything and everything. You know, in other words, we'll fly you to the moon like Virgin.
Right. Okay.
And they'll dictate everything. But when it comes down to public safety and public domain stuff, then there needs to be at least some minimum standards to where, you know, the public safety is being addressed, and it's not, you know, the guy that's the cheapest, you know, hey, if you fly on this, we don't care. We won't check you because we don't have any of that overhead. I mean, I don't think many people would fly on that aircraft.
Okay. All right.
Just due to the fact that it's wide open. So the terrorists would fly on it. And then that would cause a problem as well of allowing a terrorist to actually weaponize an airplane. So there needs to be some level of safety and regulations that the states need to impose. And it's the same thing with, if the states actually had control over the national aircraft, do you really believe that we would have chemtrails today?
No.
There you go. No. So when we really start looking at, you know, how important it is that the states actually do their job and take away this federal tyranny, I think that really begs the, you know, the clarity here, what we need to do. Now, the one thing I was really talking about on the Fourth Amendment, and I'm going to use a grocery store because this is what I was really looking for. You know, we all see the obvious out there in the public domain, but are you monitored at your grocery store?
Oh, yeah, sure. There are cameras everywhere.
There's not just that.
Every place.
Not just right that. Here. Grocery stores employ this concept of, you, if you become a member, we will actually give you a discount on what you spend on specific items. We'll have sales, and they have, you know, a certain percentage of the products that they sell discounted to members.
Right.
And what do they do with that information?
What they do is they keep track of that so they can give you a discount.
Well, right? There's that, but they actually keep track of what you buy.
Yes.
And they actually they share that data, the data of what you personally buy as a member. Why do they care? Why do they need your name? You know, if you're going to come in and shop here, why is it that they need to have your name, address, and all of that personal information? Why don't they just give you a card to say, you know, if you you don't have to become a member, but if you come here often, here's a card that will give you this return investment. In other words, there's a reason why they want your personal data.
Well, they want to send you ads.
Well, there's that. You know? Because okay. Actually, the ads that come in, and today it's gotten into the digital era, that nowadays mm-hmm. a member, they're pushing the fact that you have to be a digital member.
Right.
Where, in other words, they now know when you walk in their store because they use geofencing. Okay, so-and-so's here, and they keep track of everywhere you walk and everything you've purchased.
And they give you a discount to do that.
That's correct. But the fact of the matter is, you have a right to be secure in your person. And if they sell that information and they share that to somebody else who you did not allow, but they say, oh, well, you know, by allowing us to do this, we have the ability to, because we now own your data. Can you actually sign a contract that allows a company to own your data? They're creating and collecting data. They got these matrices and they're doing this. But do they have the ability to say they really own it so that they can sell it to other marketers and other businesses and to the government?
It's your data, right?
Right. So what that means is, but the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. Well, when you go into a grocery store and they're monitoring everything you do, that's the same thing as a police state. And to maintain that data, to create a database on going, because, you know, this has actually been a good way of preventing some things, because they've actually started equating, you know, fertilizer and certain chemicals. People create bombs. And so if you go into a home improvement center and you buy a bunch of fertilizer and you buy all this other equipment and they keep track of that and they have somebody that's monitoring that, well, they were able to track this person that was out to create these bad bombs, like Timothy McVeigh.
Right.
And so they've created laws to basically have these corporations like Home Depot and so forth actually become active monitors for the police state and report information so that anybody that buys this type of material, you need to report. With the war on drugs, if you buy too many, you know, Tylenol Sinus or what have you, because it could be, you know, ported into methane or not methane, but mesk or whatever. you know what I'm talking about, meth. Then, okay, so they report that, and then the DEA come knocking on your door.
Right.
Right. So what do we have here? We actually have, because bottom line, when, you know, you actually go and you say, hey, I don't want that data going anywhere. And mm-hmm. they go, well, you signed this agreement that we can actually share this. I think that's unconstitutional. I think that the only way they can share that data is to have a court. And I honestly think, folks, that we really need to peel this back, that when a court does sign a warrant, the individual that the data has been shared needs to be notified that that data is now, you're being monitored. You know, your data has been sent to government.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
And a lot of people look at that as, well, it's tipping off the criminals. Yeah, but what the real problem is that government should not be using corporations as intelligence gatherers. That violates that right. Go ahead.
Well, the other thing is, you can't say you're tipping off the criminals because a person is presumed innocent until found guilty, right? So how can you call someone a criminal? You know what I mean? How can you call someone a criminal if you're just investigating? You can't assume someone is a criminal.
Yeah, right? Correct. Absolutely. You're innocent until proven guilty. So, which is why I think we need to bend over backwards in ensuring that, you know, what you do on Amazon, whether it be online or whether you walk into an Amazon store, Best Buy, or what have you, whatever you do, you know, you have a right to be secure in your person of what you're doing. When it comes down to anybody monitoring what you're buying and what you're doing, and that getting into the hands of government to be able to, you know, create a digital footprint, to create this digital domain, you know, data on you. Here's everything that this person's purchased. Are you kidding me? How is that not a violation of the Fourth Amendment? Now, we've even gotten things to a point where the question is, do they have the ability to track you?
Yes.
Yes, they do.
They are.
And as
they
a matter of fact, that's right. And we've exposed this facial recognition, you know, with our association, past association with the Constitutional Alliance, you know, in their work in trying to stop this, you know, automatic recognition technology where they're actually using facial recognition technology to identify you whenever you pop up on a camera. They identify, boom, this person was there walking in this direction or what have you, because they can tell what direction you're facing and that you were there at that point in time. And they're keeping that data. So the question is, how is it that you're secure in your person, even in the public domain, if they're monitoring the fact and if government is obtaining and having this data? Whether it's coming from the grocery store or whether it's coming from a government camera on an intersection because it's for flow, the traffic and the flow of foot traffic or what have you. They have no right to be monitoring who's walking on that street and maintaining this database. You have a right to be secure in your person that government doesn't know where you are or what you're doing unless they have a reason to say, why are you here? And then at that point, they will go, okay, well, who are you? But to search you or to actually be searching and finding you and maintaining tabs on every person, this is absolutely unacceptable. This goes into DNA as well.
Right.
Right? So there have been cases, and this actually proves the right of securing, being secure in your person, that when law enforcement maybe, you know, collects your DNA with a search warrant because you're a suspect in a homicide or what have you, and they, your DNA proves that you weren't the criminal, you weren't a viable suspect, they're supposed to expunge that data. But what they do is they take that DNA and they run it through, and basically that's a fingerprint, and they run it through their system, and they, oh, well, this person was involved in this crime. Mm-hmm. Or later on, a person does commit the crime, and because they still have that data on file, by law, they're supposed to expunge that because you're still innocent. You've Correct. Been proven innocent because your mm-hmm. data, your DNA did not match that the person of interest. Anyway.
In other words, they should destroy that, expunge it, and start from fresh.
Absolutely. Every case, they have to build their case based on the facts. They shouldn't mm-hmm. be able to have a database to say, okay, we, you know, we've got everybody's data. See, the military, why does the military have your DNA?
If you're a soldier, it's probably so they can identify you.
There you go. If you get blown up to bits, you know, right. and there's nothing that's recognizable because mm-hmm. you were ground zero at the blast, and right. you're just, I mean, fragments of the remains, then mm-hmm. the only way they're going to be able to capture you is, you know, that you were killed is by these remains. And so
sure.
they said, okay, this makes sense to do that. But that database should never be used for criminal investigation. The purpose of that database is for one purpose and one purpose alone. So in other words, the only reason that that database should be accessed is for the purpose it was designed, not for a pool to say, okay, you know, we have so many people going in and out of the military that, you know, we have a good capture of 40% of American right. citizens. That's unacceptable.
Yeah. So that's, I'd like to run something else by you really quick.
Sure.
We may cover it, but have you ever heard of this thing called the Open Fields Doctrine?
I've heard of it, but go ahead and explain it.
So I've got a page up. Let me share what it is. It is, I'll just read you a couple paragraphs. In Hester versus the United States, the Supreme Court held that the Fourth Amendment did not protect open fields, and that therefore police searches in such areas as pastures, wooded areas, open water, and vacant lots need not comply with the requirements of warrants and probable cause. Let me go down for a little bit further. And then here's one, says the court held that, quote, an individual may not legitimately demand privacy for activities conducted out of doors in fields, except in the area immediately surrounding the home, end quote. So there was a case in which a homeowner or a landowner had his home on this piece of property and discovered that the feds had put cameras on his property. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, he sued, and it appears that they said because it was not in the immediate vicinity of his home, feds could do what they wanted. Okay. So this open fields doctrine says that your property, even though it may, if it's not immediately surrounding your home, it is not protected by the Fourth Amendment.
Even though it's on your property.
Even though it's your property. Okay, it's called the open fields doctrine.
Okay.
Okay, so a lot of people are not familiar with this.
Okay. That's fine. Mm-hmm. We've got just a minute left.
Okay.
And right. So I don't know if we can actually dispatch with this. So we'll have to carry the Fourth Amendment over in the next episode. So when we come back on Monday.
But, I'll send you a link to this.
Okay, that's great. But here's the thing. This is a precedence in a very particular case. And mm-hmm. the court actually used this. And so did this go to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court ruled and allowed this doctrine to become what they call this edict of the court law?
I believe so.
And if that's the case, then this is an absolute violation of the Constitution, because the courts do not have the authority to redefine the Constitution. This is the same thing as Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. They cannot redefine what privacy is. That has to go back to the states, and the state, because it's the state's compact, not the courts. Mm-hmm. And when the states have actually delineated what this line meant, we actually have the debates of the Bill of Rights. And it was very, very specific. So as you can see, we're out of time. So with that, folks, this really helps open the doors when we dive into all of this detail. I hope you appreciate this. I hope this is helpful in helping you understand the Constitution, because there's all sorts of ways our Constitution and our rights are being attacked. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaim the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.